Did you know that your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body truly is? It's true. Your biological age, the age of your cells and organs, is actually the number one predictor of your risk for serious diseases like heart disease, cancer, dementia, and more. That's why learning your biological age can be truly life-changing, and that's what the True Age Test from True Diagnostic helps you do. With just a simple at-home test, you can uncover your true biological age and get personalized insights into your true biological age and take control of your health like never before. No doctor's visits, no labs, just a quick finger prick from the comfort of your home. As you guys know, I care a lot about fitness and lifestyle because I do triathlons, and it's really important for me to take care of my health. So here's the thing that really inspired me. Up to 90% of biological aging is driven by lifestyle. That means the way we eat, move, sleep, and manage stress plays a massive role in how fast or slow our bodies age. True Diagnostic just doesn't tell you your biological age. It gives you a personalized report of full, clear, science-backed steps you can take to actually slow down aging and improve your health over time. I'm really excited to see the results and see what they have to say about my health because, as I said, I do take it very seriously. The test itself is super easy, just a quick, painless finger prick. You send in your sample using a prepaid mailer, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you get detailed online reports with actionable insights that you can use. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code TSNOTYA to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's true, truediagnostic.com, and use TSNOTYA at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
Beta Reader Matchup Time is happening again. It's been so gratifying over the summer to be tagged in so many posts about beta readers who've become writing besties and who are still going strong many years after they were first matched. Some even travel to meet up and do writing weekends together, which sounds incredible. I can't guarantee any of that. That's entirely up to you. But what I can guarantee is that you'll be matched with a group of people working in your genre and or time zone who will critique 3,000 words of your work as you critique theirs in return. You can sign up from now until the 31st of August with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of September. Head to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab. Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Hi everyone and welcome back to another Books with Hooks. Today we have our author joining us, which we're very excited about. Telly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bianca. I'm so excited to be here.
We're excited to have you here. Will you please kick us off by reading your query letter?
Of course, I'd be delighted to. Dear Cece, Carly, and Bianca, thank you for having me on Books with Hooks. I'm a big fan of the podcast, which has been an incredible resource throughout my writing journey. This query was tailored with Cece in mind, as her wish list mentions a desire for stories centered around social justice and feminist issues, core themes in my manuscript. I so appreciate the opportunity to share my work with you. I am seeking representation for The Color of Blood, a 70,000-word coming-of-age horror romance. The novel blends Latvian mythology and folklore with an examination of critical theory similar to Blood Over Brighthaven, the Gothic horror and exploitation of Mexican Gothic, and the Eastern European setting of Juniper and Thorn. In 1900 Latvia, women combined their blood with pigment to create magical art that comes to life. Stasi, an ambitious painter, is chosen to compete for a coveted art residency hosted by the von Nachtraben family, Europe's most powerful paint magnate. But rumor has it a past competitor was terribly disfigured. Still, Stasi eagerly accepts. After all, the competition is a chance to elevate her social standing, earn her emotionally distant parents' approval, and escape the brothel where she secretly works. At the von Nachtraben estate, Stasi is forced to share a room with Helmi, her art school rival. Even worse, the grisly rumor becomes all too real. A fellow competitor is gruesomely killed, forcing Stasi and Helmi to set aside their differences and uncover the dark truth behind the competition. When their investigation leads them to a toxic green pigment engineered to weaken women who paint, they suspect the purpose of the competition isn't to identify the strongest magical women, but to eliminate them. As a forbidden sapphic romance kindles between Stassi and Helmi, and more women perish, the rivals to lovers navigate deadly trials, backstabbing competitors, and the Von Nachtreben's insidious web of control. Stassi will risk her love and her life to stop the elite intent on silencing women and append the rarefied world she once longed to join. I'm a neurodivergent PhD candidate. I graduated summa cum laude with a degree in environmental studies and a minor in French, concentrating on French literature and linguistics. I later earned a JD MBA with distinction, but after several years practicing corporate law, I found that drafting contracts and closing deals left little room for creative expression. Since then, my passion for storytelling has taken over my life, and I won my first writing contest, the Seven Stories Writing Competition. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'd be thrilled to share this story with you. And that comes in at 368 words without the personalization.
Amazing, Tally. Thank you so much. Okay, Cece, we're going to throw it over to you.
This is such a brilliant query letter. You did such a good job reading it too. You know how to write and read a query letter. It's really impressive. Truly, I read this query letter and you'll see this in my notes in our Substack supporters will too. I really want a coming of age horror romance. Like the plot points were just killing me in the best way. You gave me exactly what I needed to know in terms of the journey, in terms of the escalation. Like I literally wrote in the margins, you are killing me in the best way. It's perfect as is, and you should be very proud of it. If you want me to be super, super, super nitpicky, because you're on the show and you're asking for advice, there could be potential to sharpen the why her angle. Like right now, it could be any student's story. Like, why is she the one to fight the good fight? But truthfully, like just saying, I don't actually need to know the answer to this, because if this had been in my query inbox, I would have been like, oh my gosh, yes, scrolling down to read this. With urgency, with pleasure, with curiosity, which is exactly the goal. So congratulations.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, handing it across to you now.
All right. So my goal this summer is to help everybody work on their hooks. In our last episode where we did a query letter, I went through some examples of different ways to write your hook. And so for you, actually, I don't think you have a hook written down here. So do you want to unmute yourself and just say, like, what do you think your hook is?
Okay, so by hook, do you mean my pitch, like that little elevator pitch?
I mean your log line, your elevator pitch, exactly, yeah.
Okay, so it's Stassi mixes her blood with paint to create magical art, like youth restoring portraits, but when she discovers a plot to eradicate powerful female artists, she'll risk her forbidden sapphic love and her life to rise against the powerful elite who would silence her.
Okay, so why don't you have that in here?
I currently do. This is a previous iteration, unfortunately.
Okay, good. I'm putting you on the spot. Okay, because so for me, the way that I read this one is that where the hook should be, what you have is Latvian mythology and folklore with an examination of critical theory. Like that's where your hook should go. And so you are coming off super academic here when what we need is like, that's where the juicy part of the hook goes. So I'm glad to hear that you have a hook, that you have an elevator pitch. Do you want to hear some of my examples? I went through with my query formulas and put together some for you. So I'll run through them, keep them, you know, leave them, whatever. This is also a good exercise for everybody listening because it just shows there's lots of different ways to write your hook in a way that, you know, can service your story in different ways. So last time I went through some examples of the character goal obstacle formula, the character situation complication formula, the character desire conflict formula, the what if question formula, and the irony or twist formula. So I'm going to kind of use those formulas. These are all from my author's publishing playbook. So everybody has access to them there. And if you're not in the playbook, you know where to go to find it. Okay, so let's go through some of your examples. I want to start with the in a world format. So this doesn't work for everybody, but because there's some world building here, I just wanted to run through some examples. I actually think in a world works here. So anyway, I'm going to run through them. In a world where magical art is born from women's blood and power is wielded by a sinister patriarchy, Stassi wants to elevate her social standing and prove her worth, only to discover she must risk everything to fight for the very women her society intends to silence. I kind of like a in a world one here, just throwing that out there. Another one, In a world where elite families exploit and disfigure magical women, Stassi wants to win a prestigious art residency, but she finds herself caught in a deadly conspiracy and a forbidden romance that forces her to choose between survival and revolution. So again, some more examples here. All of our Substack subscribers will see I've written out 5 different examples for everybody to check out, and just showing you there's different ways to write your hook in a way that can service the story, service the query letter. You also don't want to make your query letter too long by writing a hook that essentially like summarizes the query letter in itself, but I'm glad to hear that your more recent edition has a hook in it, because this is a very hooky story, and I think that you weren't like doing the pitch justice by just kind of running through the plot points as opposed to let's just start off with something that's really going to grab our attention. So glad to hear that. The word horomance. I am not familiar with the term horomance. It doesn't roll off the tongue especially great. I know on this show we read them aloud. So if it is something where, you know, TikTok is talking about horomance, I mean, it's a thing that we need to lean into, then that's fine. But it's, again, doesn't roll off the tongue super, super easily, but, you know, not my business if that works here. My last question is kind of like, is this YA or adult? Because you call this coming of rage, and I love the word coming of rage. It's awesome. But I'm not really clear on whether this is adult or YA. So I would probably find a way to signal to us which it is in a way that's a bit more clear. I kind of thought it was adult because coming of rage is a pun on coming of age, which is generally more like an adultification look back on our childhood. We'll get to the pages later where I think it's definitely more YA, but I do think you should probably spell that out a bit more. But other than that, you know, little notes for you here and there, which again, our Substack subscribers will see. But yeah, just my pro hook stance as always. We need to leap with a hook.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Tally, we're going to hand it across to you now where you can either answer those questions or ask questions of your own.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that feedback. That is super helpful. So, Carly, in terms of your point of what is the audience for this? So it's interesting, actually, I was speaking with an editor at Macmillan on Monday, and she had mentioned that this is very much a crossover piece. So I had written it intending it to be adult, and that's how I saw it with the themes. But it falls into young adult as well because of the writing, and especially the first person and the voice, I think, could appeal to young adult. So this editor that I was talking to, I think she primarily focuses on young adult, and she said she'd be interested in seeing the project once it's represented. So that was really exciting. But anyway, so I think it does have a crossover appeal. I would probably market it as adult, but is there an ability to play around with that? I know there's the new adult market that you can play to, but do I have to decide at this point who the audience is and stick with that? Or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think something we've debated a lot on the show and the industry debates a lot. So there isn't one magical answer. I will say there is a level in which you have to commit to something, because with you pitching editors, or, you know, your agents again, and I know you had a conversation with an editor, but your eventual agent will pitch editors. These are completely different categories, often in different buildings with teams that do not communicate with each other at all. Separate marketing departments with separate specialties between kids and adults. So they are very, very different in how they kind of function with their audiences, often the market in terms of like whether library is a primary market for them, for example, or schools. So there's definitely a certain level of needing to commit very early on. There are select imprints that do crossover work, and that is their goal. And I have a feeling I know who you're talking about in terms of, you know, the imprints that you're talking to. But when you think about going out on submission with something, you know, sometimes a first round will be 7 to 12 editors. And then again, if it doesn't sell, we go to, you know, another round and another round. Like, so we need a basket of like 30 editors to be able to submit to. And so if you think like, this is new adult, or this is has to hit a crossover editor, all of a sudden we took, you know, if you could imagine like the diagram where it's like the two circles and they're crossing over. What diagram is that? Venn diagram. Thank you. My literary background did not take me all the way to math class. So our Venn diagram, right? Where it's like, this is our adult circle. This is our kid lit circle. How close do these two do this? Like barely, right? They're touching. And so that's the little sliver in the middle where we're attacking that category. And it's just so small. And so I find, in my experience, if something wants to be crossover, it has to be the best at what it is doing and therefore creates crossover momentum, because it is then word of mouth and carries itself into the next category. So to me, crossover is, it's a lot of things. And it's, I think a lot of people want to be crossover. So again, people can call themselves whatever they want, but it's a mix of audience, it's a mix of marketing, it's a mix of positioning, it's a mix of packaging. It's just so many things. So it's kind of a long-winded way of saying, I think you need to pick, and I think it's why.
Yeah, I think that I would agree. And that's really fascinating feedback in terms of the actual marketing the book to editors' point of view. That's really interesting insight that I'm glad to glean here.
Do you have any other questions, Telly, for Carly and Cece, or any other input based on the query letter before we go to what's in the pages?
I don't really believe so. I want to work my joke about the bear in here.
So Telly noticed that she, you can tell us what you noticed. And I said, it was too late. They already have the pages.
Yeah, I was mortified. I was looking at the query letter as I was editing it, and I saw that I had written grizzly as in the bear instead of grizzly as in, you know, scary. So I told Bianca I'd have to work a bear into the manuscript, so it was foreshadowing and not a typo. But that was just my
little bears love me. I didn't even notice, which tells you how much I know about that.
Oh my God, we are not going back to bears love you again.
Bears love me. Bears love me. Bears love me, and they would be my friends, guys. Everybody knows this.
Listen, bears as in the gay men also love me, but not the wild bears. So, okay.
No, talk about wild bears. Wild bears.
Okay. Right. Oh, we will move swiftly along from there. I would just like to stop here because we are having a word from our sponsor.
This spring, watching everything outside bloom, I'm also watching my kids blossom in their French immersion program at school. It's amazing, but also a big motivator for me, especially because we are headed to France next month. I want to be able to join in more, you know? Je veux commander un café à Paris. If you want to connect more with your kids' language journey or maybe prep for your own adventure this season, Rosetta Stone helps build those skills. Rosetta Stone is the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years, offering an immersive and effective approach that helps you absorb and retain new language naturally on desktop and mobile, wherever and whenever it fits your lifestyle. It is a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered: Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and so many more. There's fast language acquisition. You can immerse in so many ways. No English translations. It's an intuitive process. And don't forget the speech recognition true accent feature. It gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's very convenient, flexible learning anytime, anywhere, on the go with the mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. And there's amazing value. Lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and language needs in your life. Lifetime access. So don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. The Shit About Writing listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. With summer in full swing and packing for different getaways and vacations, I feel that familiar pull to refresh my closet for all the different versions of myself I'm going to be this summer, but I'm trying not to waste money on pieces I'm only going to wear once or just for one season. It's best to get things that we can wear in as many ways as possible, and that's where Quince comes in. Their clothes are timeless, feel luxurious, look elevated, and the quality is way beyond what you'd expect for the price. It's the kind of wardrobe upgrade that just sticks. Think 100% European linen tops starting at $30, washable silk dresses and skirts, and soft cotton sweaters. Versatile warm weather pieces you'll reach for again and again. The best part, everything with Quince is half the cost of similar brands. By working directly with top artisans, cutting out the middlemen, Quince gives you luxury without the markup, and Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I purchased the Mongolian cashmere tee in heather gray. So soft, so chic. The quality and price blew me away. I don't know why I would pay mall prices when I have Quince. And I've worn it in so many ways since I got it. I have a funky look where I pair it with leopard print shorts, or I can go clean and classic with dress pants or a mini skirt, or layer it with a white t-shirt underneath for a Gen Z look. I highly recommend the versatility of their well-made basics. I also grabbed a pair of blue kids swim trunks with sharks on them. Super cute. So if you're listening to this, we are in the south of France and my son is wearing them right now. Give your summer closet an upgrade with Quince. Go to quince.com/TSNOTYAW for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/TSNOTYAW to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/TSNOTYAW.
Okay, right. So Tally, we are now moving to the pages. Can you please summarize for us what is in those opening pages?
So we begin with Stassi in the halls of her school, and she overhears other students talking about a rumor that some girl was set ablaze. So that catches her attention, and she starts thinking, oh my goodness, what is going on? This must be about this competition that every artist wants to get into. And so she makes her way to her classroom. We learn a bit about Stassi. She's always late. She walks into her class, and her professor chastises her a little bit. And then we find out that Stassi has actually been chosen for this competition where somebody was set ablaze. And her rival is also going to be joining her there. We learn a little bit about the magic system and how it works with blood weaving, which essentially artists mix their blood with paint. They paint subjects before them, and that affects the natural subject that they see. And then at the end of these first five pages, a big glob of green paint flies past Stassi's face and lands on her canvas.
Wonderful, Tally. Thank you so much. Okay, Cece, we're going to hand it across to you again.
I am making a face because I have a lot of notes. So I will not be able to share all the notes, but you can absolutely read my notes once you have them and let me know if you need me to elaborate on anything else. Unlike the query letter where I was like, I have no notes. I have a lot of notes. My first note is there are some really beautiful lines. I really, really enjoyed the care that you put into this. I made sure to like highlight the moments where you were like, oh my God, this is beautiful writing. Thank you. Thank you for writing this beautiful writing. I'm going to read one for our listeners. The boom slicing our anticipation like a blade against bone. It's referring to a movement with a knife. It's simple, right? But it's so evocative. The imagery is so powerful. And it's so baked into the scene. Like this is in the middle of like dialogue. So you did a really good job there. And I could see the care that you put into this. So thank you. There were also really good moments of emotional calibration. There's one moment where the calibration's off, but all the other moments, it was perfectly in tune. And again, hard to do. So really want to congratulate you for that. I do have a lot of notes on how to improve this. The first is tone. So Carly mentioned horror romance. I don't know how to say this either. It's very hard to pronounce. I totally agree. It does not roll off the tongue. I know it is a thing because I'm obsessed with Isabel Cañas, specifically Vampires of El Norte, but really anything the woman writes, I will read. And it's 100% like a genre. People are obsessed with it. I'm obsessed with it. So I do think we should have picked a better word as a community, but we didn't, and that's fine. The tone isn't there. Like we don't have a horror romance tone, a horror, whatever the word is tone. I encourage you to read the genre to see how from the very first chapter, there's that eeriness, that sense of danger. Like we have her eavesdropping. I thought, ooh, there's going to be danger because she's eavesdropping, but there isn't. Her interiority actually tells us, you know, no use being caught. I'm going to be late for class. It's all very low stakes and safe. Like you're keeping her safe and you can't keep her safe if this is your genre. It read like YA. When I read the query letter, I did not think it might be YA. I didn't catch that. That's on me. But when I read the pages, I was like, this reads like YA. You have to decide what it is, obviously. And I 100% agree with Carly. You have to make a decision. If you try to make your manuscript crossover, 9 times out of 10, what happens is it ends up being neither. You know, so you end up actually losing both markets as opposed to gaining both markets. It sounds unfair. It is unfair, but it's also life. So let's live in life. But the tone and the writing, I think you need to decide what you want it to be. And I can't make that decision for you. I would be more excited if it were adult, kind of like Isabel Cañas. That's my preference as a reader, but this isn't my book. When it comes to interiority, one note I have for you, and this is an easy fix, but you're going to have to go through your whole manuscript. You are clearly writing this for a non-Latvian reader. Like you're clearly writing this for a US reader, I imagine, right? Or Canadian reader. My point is, like, she's saying things like, it's the highest honor, a Latvian artist. Like she's saying things that you wouldn't think. Like I grew up in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I wouldn't think this is the greatest honor that a Brazilian can. I would just think this is the greatest honor. You don't think to the audience that you're writing for. The protagonist doesn't think for the audience they're writing for. Like, the protagonist is in their own bubble. They might say things like, we're talking about a competition, but they might say things like, all of Europe recognizes this honor, or, you know, it's a top honor in Europe or in the world or internationally recognized. They might think that, but you don't keep qualifying your location because it's just normal for her. That's the only place she's ever lived, right? So that's really, really important to remember. And it's one of those tells where it's like, not authentic, you know? Like, I get that it's probably your background. I imagine it is anyway. But my point is, you're not thinking like somebody who grew up there. And you have to, because you have to inhabit her head. The other thing, and this is really the big note. Tali, I am saying this with love. I am going to diagnose you. Are you ready for your diagnosis? Not if you are. Shake your head if you are not. Okay, you are. All right, here goes your diagnosis. Drum rolls. You are, my dear, an over-explainer. It's what you are. You are explaining way too much, way too much. Like, you are going to be tired of reading my notes, because in every page, there's like three or four highlights with me going, why are you explaining this to me? Why are you explaining this to me? And even things like, I'm trying to think of a really good example, but when she's thinking about her friendship with her now rival, she thinks back to the little village where they grew up, and you explain where the village is. I'm not going to know how to pronounce the village's name, so I'm sorry, but it reads like this. Once, Wilhelmina and I were friends, two young girls gathering berries in the woods and bathing in sunlit streams near her family's home in Vek Pjabala, a quiet village in northern Latvia. Why would you say quiet village in northern Latvia? Like, why? Like, why? Like, let us figure this out. I get why. Like, I know why. The why is you want the reader to know what's going on. You want to do a good job. You want to be a good student and show your work. Do not show your work. That is not your job. Your job is to seduce, not to explain. There are three C's that go into every strong beginning: curiosity, context, and connection. You need to tone down the context. Context needs to feel organic. A, you have to trust that the reader doesn't have to know everything right away. That's part of it. But it's also like, it can't be a situation where you're explaining it to me. It needs to be a situation where it comes naturally and organically. A really good book for you to read for this line is The Bandit Queens by Perini Schroff. In the first chapter, we have her, the protagonist, letting the reader know that Salome, the woman that Gita is talking to, Gita is the protagonist, was her childhood best friend. But she doesn't explain it. She weaves it in. She bakes it into the story in a way that feels really, really organic. And when it comes to the world building, especially because this requires so much world building, over-explanation can just kill the mood. You know, it removes the reader from the story. It reminds the reader, someone is writing this for my benefit being the reader, and the reader doesn't want that. So the best way to learn how to do this is to read another book. A book I highly recommend is Gutter Child by J.L. Richardson. Take a look at the way the author wove in what the gutter system is. Like, we have references to the gutter system throughout the beginning of the novel. Had no idea what it was. I had theories. I had a notion that the gutter was a scary place and that the protagonist didn't want to go there. And that as much as she was in the school, at least it wasn't the gutter. But I don't know what the gutter is. And when we finally learn what the gutter system is, it's in dialogue. It's super organic. It makes sense. It's not two characters talking about things they already know. It's so, so baked in and well done. So I highly recommend reading that book too, so you can take a look at how to do that. It's going to elevate your craft so much. That all being said, I'm not convinced that you're starting in the right place. There's not enough of disruption. I don't know if you meant for the disruption to be the eavesdropping, but that's low stakes because it's not a big deal. All she's doing is eavesdropping. There's no danger. I don't know if you meant for the disruption to be the fact that she gets the position, right? Her and her friend. But that's like good news, you know? So it's like not super... I think that if you're going for this genre blend, which is honestly one of my favorite genre blends, possibly my favorite, and it's so much fun to read a book that has both horror and romance. Did you notice how I avoided saying the word there, the hard word? I just think that it has to be a different place to start. And I don't know if you have other ideas of places to start. I just don't know, but you have the talent, and I think you should trust your talent and stop explaining, because I promise the reader will get it.
Thank you, Cece. We'll have an opportunity to brainstorm with Tally. And Tally, like, as somebody who wrote her debut that was based in South Africa, I completely understand this need to contextualize and to explain and to orient the reader, especially if you've had beta readers. Because sometimes I remember when my debut was being beta read, people would be like, I don't know what this place looks like. I don't know where this place is. And so you tend to put those in to orient your beta readers as you're going along, and then that can take readers out of the story. So I totally get the struggle here and why it's so difficult. We're going to hand across to Carly, and then we'll come back to you, Tally, and then we can brainstorm potentially in terms of disruption. So Carly?
I agree with Cece. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I definitely think we're not starting in the right place, and you're writing this for the reader, not for the story. And I think those are some problems that I would diagnose here. I would think, so I'm trying to think back, I haven't read Mexican Gothic in a while, but doesn't that start with her in a carriage on the way to the house? I'm thinking that that might work here better, where it's like she's already, you know, a finalist and she's like on her way or something like that. I think that could work there, because then it's like, I think she kind of describes the landscape in the house, like as she's driving up towards it, from what I remember. It's been a while. That could work here a bit better. I think the school setting feels young. Again, if you want it to be YA, it's YA. It is very clearly she's in a school. So that definitely solidifies that. I also kind of felt like this felt a bit more modern than like a 1900s setting. I don't know if that was a goal for it to read a little bit modern, which isn't a bad thing. I was just kind of curious about, yeah, your relationship with it as a historical, because it's essentially, it's a horror romance, but it's also kind of a historical fantasy as well, because there's magical elements in a historical setting. So there's lots of things to play with here. It's very interesting. And I think that's what Cece and I keep like circling around. We're like, this is fascinating. We're sold. Like, you sold us on this concept from the query, from the hook, like you got us. And now we're thinking, okay, now we're worried that you're just not writing it in the right way to get the outcome that you want. And I think that's what we're coming up against. So it's always hard, again, for us to read five pages and feel like we're giving a full assessment or anything like that, because we're certainly not. But there is often a lot that we can see in the first five pages that dictates where we potentially think things might go. So you'll see all my notes in the margin. But to me, it almost felt like she was breaking the fourth wall. Like, that's how much I thought that she was talking to the reader. And so if you want to break the fourth wall, that's a strategy. You lean into that. You carry the reader along and you talk to them, and they're your companion. Like, that's a style, you know, again, that's a structural stylistic thing that you can do. But if you're not trying to break the fourth wall, then there's a lot of work you have to do to think about, what can I just like cut, delete, don't need. But I also agree that we're not starting in the right place. So I think we have to start closer to, I always say, we have to start at the most interesting point in a character's life. Starting at the regular day at school, even if the outcome is going to be surprising, you're starting at a regular day at school. And maybe she does or doesn't know that the announcement is going to be made today. Would she have been late if she knew the announcement was going to be made today? Like, I just don't think the interiority was focusing on the right things. You know, I don't want to be late today. Today's the day of the announcement, right? Like, that's a different thing than, oh, I got a little distracted wandering into school. Oh, all of a sudden my life has changed. So I think what is the most, I mean, you know better than me, it's your story. What is the most interesting point in this character's life? It's going to be the day she probably shows up at the state, in my opinion. So those are some things that I'm thinking about. You know, you'll see all my notes, but I definitely think it's YA. And I definitely think you have to think about, who is this story serving? And as much as you as a aspiring author want to be serving the reader, which is, again, so much good intention, as Cece and I said, like, we can see all that good intention. You want to serve your future reader, which is incredible. You also have to serve the story, you know, and just like that purity of storytelling, which I think you're thinking about your future reader, as opposed to like, what's the purest version of the story that I can tell? Because your hook is there, your story's there.
I just want to quickly say, you will serve the reader by serving the story. That's how it works. Like, it doesn't look like it, but just serve the story and you'll serve the reader.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, we're going to hand it across to Tally now. Perhaps you can tell us about a moment of disruption that comes later, and we can brainstorm to see if that might be a better entry point.
Okay, so I think that there are two potential alternate starting points. So one is the evening of this day when she learns that she's going to be in this competition is when she goes to her brothel for the last time and tells her madam that she's not going to be working there anymore. And a man comes in, he has a raven masquerade mask on, and he warns her against something. It's very unclear what exactly it is, but it has something to do with the competition. So I think that could be a starting point. And then the next morning is when she actually leaves her home and goes to the competition. So I think that could be a starting point. So I'm a bit torn between those two.
Does the brothel come back at all? Like, is this a recurring theme, or did we leave the brothel behind for the whole story?
It's a recurring theme in that the brothel represents her position in society right now. And at the beginning of the book, she really thinks that she wants to be on this higher rung on the social ladder. Then she learns that the brothel is kind of another way of keeping her stagnant.
Is she a sex worker, or is she like a receptionist? Like, what's her job?
She's a sex worker. So she's a courtesan.
Okay. So I have a lot of thoughts now, because I don't think that is the right spot. But also marrying what you have on the page with the fact that she's a sex worker or part-time or whatever capacity is very complicating. Cece, is this blowing your mind a little bit too?
No, I have an idea.
Oh, you have an idea? Oh, I love ideas. Okay, go, Cece.
Yeah. Okay, this is what you do. This is going to be a very good idea. Get prepared. Your brain's going to explode. She is walking to the brothel. We don't know this as the reader, okay? But we see the anticipation. She has to get work done. She wants to go in and go out and do what she has to do and live this life. She runs into someone from the school, okay? The someone from the school talks to her, and through dialogue, we understand she's a student. And so we, the reader, are assuming, oh, the place she's going is something to do with the school. That's the anticipation. That's the urgency. But she doesn't like school, clearly, because she just wants to, you know, get in and get out. And she lies to this person because it's a secret, right? That she's a sex worker. So she lies to this person, very important to lie. And she tells this person, you know, oh, I'm just going to go, I don't know, buy a book or something. Like, you're going to figure out what the thing is, but something inoffensive. And the person gets suspicious and goes, you wouldn't be here to buy a book. You're clearly trying to get an edge in the competition by going to so-and-so's house or something. Like, they have a theory that has nothing to do with a brothel. And so the reader's thinking, oh my God, is that what she's actually going to do? And so the reader now thinks that this person's theory is correct. And because we see her get nervous, she can't find out, but there's actually something more. She gets to the brothel. But again, we don't know it's actually a brothel yet. And then we are surprised, we the reader, by her doing something like, I don't know, taking her clothes off or something. Because it's like, oh, that's not a magical student job description. So now the reader is surprised. The reader has been surprised many times now. But then, bam, there's a second surprise. The person she actually takes her clothes off for, or whatever is it that she's going to do, maybe that's not her style, goes, no, no, I'm not here for that. I am actually here to deliver you news. I'm just pretending to be a customer. And then they deliver her the news that you just shared. As you were going through your options of where to start, you were focused on information, on conveying information, not what you have to focus on. I have to grab your brain and like pull this urge out of your brain right now, the urge to explain. You're focused on kickstarting the chain of events in a way that honors the information, and that's not your job. You have to focus on a place that's going to surprise the reader with character development and in a way that unlocks layers of surprise. And so I love the idea of her going to the brothel, because that's her secret life. That's what she's had to do. We have a hint of that in the pages where she says, you know, this would ruin me if people found out and stuff like that. Have that urgency, have that really, really emotionally charged scene, but make us think it's something else. And then bam, when we finally have a surprise, we think, now I know everything there is to know about her. But then she is surprised. The reader has been surprised, but now she is surprised by the customer not actually being the customer. That's what I think you should do.
Kali?
I'm just saying, I like the customer not being the customer. I think that's great. It's very magical. I'm just kind of wondering also where the horror elements are going to come in. Because you know, Cece and I have been talking about like the atmosphere, the eeriness. You have to think about that too. And so maybe, again, this happens at night. It's foggy. You know, again, get the atmosphere. What Cece said, but atmosphere.
So thinking back to Mexican Gothic, I have to go over and read it again as well to get the actual atmosphere and to see how that was built in there. But that starts with the main character being this socialite, essentially, and talking about how she likes to go to parties and she likes to spend time with boys. And, you know, her father wants her to settle down and she doesn't want that. And I think that she probably gets into the spooky atmosphere quicker than I do. I think that's probably something that I need to rush into a little bit more here. But essentially, that's kind of what I was going for. I was going for starting with, you know, the art scene and she's a student. And then when we get to the estate, that's really when everything kicks into high gear and becomes scary and atmospheric. But I do think I probably need to get into that faster.
It needs to be faster. Carly's point about night and foggy really helps. Notice that in thrillers, even though the danger begins, I don't know, in chapter 3, in chapter 1, you have her like cutting her finger. You have blood. You have something. Like, we need something. Mexican Gothic's beginning, part of the reason why it works is it's a costume party. It's not just her being a socialite. The costume gives it the eeriness. Go read Vampires of El Norte. Go read that chapter 1. All they're doing is meeting outside. Like her and Nestor. It's so spooky. Like, the tone is so spooky. So you have to find that spooky tone. It cannot come later. There's no such thing as, oh, it'll come later. Forget later. Your job is to do it now.
What if she accidentally cuts herself before the reader knows that she cuts herself to combine with the paint for magic? And there's something about like her not wanting to waste it or it's too early. I don't know. I'd play around with that a little bit, right? Because blood is such a huge theme. And I didn't say this, but I love your title for this book. But yeah, since the blood is such a big theme, I don't know, something about that could also be a little bit eerie. We're like, oh, why is she so abnormally worried about a cut when like everybody else be like, throw a band-aid on it? Or I mean, I don't know if band-aids were around in 1900, but my science background as well as my math background aren't great.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic idea, actually, working the blood in super early, because it is definitely a theme that keeps coming back over and over. And I just have to say, Cece, I love that suggestion for the beginning. I'm so excited to write this. I it's gonna be really good.
Just as an author, Tally, especially considering my last book was sort of gothic, dark and stormy night vibes, you know, from the outset, you've got to, and I'm just going to read this just to give you an idea, because in terms of setting the tone. So it says, Destiny Whip warily eyes her bedside table, which could easily be mistaken for a miniature graveyard. What with all the little pills neatly lined in staggered rows, positioned upright like tiny headstones. So do you see in the opening line, we've got a reference to cemetery, to headstones and things. So it's already setting that tone so that the reader understands this is gothic. This is kind of creepy. There's this underlying stuff. So you really have to, it's not just introducing the horror elements in terms of blood. You also need to be building that tone in terms of the language you choose, in terms of everything, you know, so that the reader starts to get those creepy vibes.
This is, I don't know if you're a Swiftie, but going back to a Taylor Swift album, Midnights, right? Where like the color red and it's crimson and it's like all the different ways to say red or say blood. You know what I mean? It's like, this is crimson. This is that. Like Bianca's saying, it's like, she's not saying, oh, dead, she's saying cemetery and headstones. You know what I'm trying to say? So like, figure out all of your words, do a big word map about like, what are all the ways that you can say blood or think about blood? And we're weaving, we're infusing, for a blood pun, we are infusing the story like with all those references.
Telly?
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. Thank you.
Yeah. And it's just as you begin writing, you know, for me, it helps to have the vision board as I'm imagining things and imagining it kind of dark. And as opposed to the reader having that picture that you're looking at, you've got to paint that picture for them so that they know it's kind of got that dark filter on everything, or that foggy filter, et cetera, et cetera. So as you're writing this new chapter, focus as well on the tone so that you can really try and capture that as well. All right. So Tally, was there anything else you wanted to ask Carly and Cece? Anything else you wanted to brainstorm before we finish up in a few minutes?
Yeah, so I guess two questions. So my first would be that one of my writer friends just approached me, and this is unrelated to the query letter and the pages, but I'm wondering in terms of marketing what your thoughts are. And she asked if I would be interested in doing a race to an agent with her. And so essentially we would publicize this on social media and both of us would compete to see who could get an agent first. And I'm torn about this because on one hand, I think it's a fun idea that would get people following us that might improve our reach and get interest. On the other, I wonder if it's gamifying something that's, you know, not necessarily appropriate to look at in that sense. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on this.
I have very strong thoughts about this. I think your instincts are right, which is this is not a good idea. And aside from the fact of like the race to the age and the gamification, here's something that everybody listening to this needs to think about. When you are trying to build a platform and a brand and followers, what you are trying to do is attract querying writer followers, because if you were to create that content, the people that would follow you would be other aspiring authors, querying authors, not the eventual readers of your book. And this is something that Lee Stein talks about a lot, who's a great author and marketing expert. She always talks about, how am I creating content on socials that serves my goals to attract future readers? And the word of mouth that I need, we don't want your word of mouth as an author brand to be the author who did the race to an agent. We want the author brand to be the author of Color of Blood. You know what I mean? So again, all that other messiness aside, really think about like, what is my content serving? Who is it serving and why?
Yeah. I also wouldn't do it because it's going to be probably the slowest race of all of mankind. It's going to be so boring. It's going to take so long because it takes so long to hear back from agents. Agents are the worst, guys. And it's just going to be like, you know, picture that really slow-mo race, like so boring. Like, don't do it, man. Like, don't do it.
Like slots.
Yeah, that's good to know. So my next question was actually going back to the editor interest. So she had mentioned, you know, I can't endorse you to agents because I haven't read the full manuscript, but you can tell agents that I'm interested. And so I'm wondering how much information to divulge. She's from Macmillan. Do I put that in the query letter? Do I put her name in, or do I say an editor at Macmillan? How do I kind of phrase that in a way that's appropriate, essentially?
Was this at a conference?
Oh, yeah. No, it was on a Zoom call, actually.
But like, how did you get on a Zoom call with her? Like through a conference, through a...
like a contest? See, she's just wondering like the frame of which like you went into the conversation.
Yeah, I reached out to her through Manuscript Academy and booked a call with her. And so we had a Zoom call and she mentioned that, you know, she liked it and was interested.
Yeah, you can write through a consultation with an editor from Macmillan via Manuscript Academy. I was told that she would be interested in this once I have representation. I have to be honest with you, and I'm saying this because I don't like false hope, okay? Every conference I go to, I meet with editors who are also taking pitches, and the thing they tell me is, I always tell writers that once they have representation, they should send things to me if the thing is in the scope they represent. It doesn't mean she didn't like your pages. I'm not suggesting that. I am saying that a smart editor always says, keep me in mind once you have an agent. Because the job of knowing when it's ready is the agent's job. That's not their job. A smart editor's job is to keep those doors open. Like, they want to keep those doors open because it's the agent's job to figure out when your story's ready to submit. Like, they don't have to worry about quality control at all. It's kind of a dreamy thing, actually, now that I think about it. Agents have to worry about that. Agents have floodgates open where we have to sift through the stuff that's ready and the stuff that's not. And then everything that's ready, we send to editors. So it's important to write that because that happened. But I don't even know. Like that happens so often in query letters I get. That line, it's really common.
And if you're wondering where to put it, you put it in the author bio. You don't lead with it because, again, CC and I see this all the time. Again, it's not a bad thing. It's just tuck it in the author bio. It probably won't get you an agent faster, but to me, it suggests this person paid for Manuscript Academy. Like, they took the extra steps to be serious about your career. So that's why it goes in the author bio paragraph.
Thank you, Carly. All right. So we've reached the end of our episode. Tali, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for making yourself vulnerable and for sharing your work. You know, it's always very difficult. And I think we brainstormed some really great beginnings for you. And it's just a case of going through your work and seeing where you put in context, where you're explaining, and it's just taking that out. So for the first draft, it's just going through and taking out all of that and see what remains and then building on that. So, you know, definitely doable. I hope we were useful, Tali.
Yes, this was fantastic. It was such an honor to speak with all of you. Thank you so much for having me on. This has been a wonderful experience. Terrifying, but wonderful.
Well, yeah, it is always terrifying because you care about your work. And I always say, if you're not making yourself vulnerable, you're not afraid. And if you're not afraid, then that means you don't care about it. So thank you so much for joining us, Tali.
Bye.
Carly, I think it's time for the thing.
Bianca, we have a fun surprise for you.
A most puzzling surprise.
A most puzzling murder surprise.
Okay, what are the two of you up to?
So we're going to play an excerpt from your latest novel, A Most Puzzling Murder, right now on our show. That's right, listeners. You'll get to listen to the first few chapters of this locked room mystery featuring an unforgettable protagonist, Destiny Whip, and more twists and turns than you can count. So if you've already enjoyed the book in print, you'll love digesting it with your ears. And if you haven't read it yet, this is the perfect amuse-bouche to get you into it. Thank you to the publisher for making this available and for giving us permission to play it. So without further ado, it's time to tune in to your next favorite novel, A Most Puzzling Murder by Bianca Murray.
Yay! This is so cool, guys!
Enjoy!
Chapter 1. Destiny. Sunday, 9:57 a.m. Destiny Whip warily eyes her bedside table, which could easily be mistaken for a miniature graveyard, what with all the little pills neatly lined in staggered rows, positioned upright like tiny headstones. It certainly feels as though she's regarding the burial ground of her hopes and dreams, haunted by the specter of the enormous potential she so dismally failed to live up to. When you're declared a child prodigy, everyone expects you to go far in life. But all Destiny has managed today is a slow shuffle to and from the bathroom. Even that required Herculean reserves of energy. Balancing her laptop on her knees, she reaches to the farthest side of the bed for her emotional support urn, pulling it close and tucking it into her armpit as though cuddling a teddy bear. She kisses the top of the teardrop shape, the metal cold against her chapped lips. Bex appears in Destiny's doorway, leaning her head against the frame. Morning, sunshine. Her best friend is still too scrawny, but not nearly as emaciated as she was a year ago, when all she feasted on was beauty magazines and models' Instagram pages, rather than anything resembling food. Bex looks mostly healthy again, her long chestnut hair gleaming, the hollows of her cheeks no longer reminiscent of sinkholes. You okay? Bex asks, the corners of her mouth turned down. It's the anniversary of the accident today. 1 year, somehow crawling by on scraped knees. Some people act like severe depression is a tarnish that can be polished off with the application of enough elbow grease. Luckily, Bex isn't one of them. Destiny tries to speak, but a knot of regret is so tangled up in her throat that the words don't stand a chance. Her laptop suddenly squawks with an incoming video call. In the months since Destiny has been seeing Dr. Shepherd, they've never had a virtual consultation over a weekend. But today is going to be a tough one, which is why the psychiatrist insisted on the appointment. As the ringing continues, Destiny gently places the urn beside her and reaches for her notebook. She pages to the list of tasks the doctor suggested last month. Bex sidles up, reading over her shoulder. 1. Leave the apartment once a day to go for a walk or grab a coffee. 2. Reach out to an old friend or colleague to suggest a meetup. 3. Replace all the dead plants. 4. Keep a dream journal about the white-haired ghost woman. 5. Email the council expressing my wish to return. 6. Accept one of the consultancies I've been offered, one that doesn't require travel. 7. Work on forgiving Nate. 8. Limit my interactions with Bex. Bex side-eyes the last item on the list. Rude, she huffs, You'd think I was a bad influence or something. Rather than answering Bex or the incoming call, Destiny thinks of how she's never flunked an assignment in her entire life. Always top of her class, and despite being admitted to university as a 12-year-old, Destiny cannot fathom this degree of failure. She's ticked nothing off the list. Not even throwing away the plants whose shriveled corpses goad her, their untimely deaths undoubtedly due to the curtains constantly being drawn tight. That, and Destiny forgetting to water them. The laptop's ringing grates on Destiny's nerves, but she can't force herself to answer and face Dr. Shepherd's disappointment. It will be carefully concealed, of course, with the psychiatrist gently pointing out there's always next week or the week after that to achieve these seemingly simple goals. But it doesn't matter how much of an extension Destiny is given. It's no use. For how can she possibly cut ties with Bex, who's her dearest, not to mention, only friend? Plus, there's no way the Council of Enigmatologists will take her back after she's been AWOL for so long. Each time an envelope drops through the mail slot, Destiny fully expects it to be a letter informing her that they've revoked her membership. It hurts to remember how thrilled she was to be appointed president of the prestigious group just 13 months ago, and how she, Bex, and Nate all splurged on a fancy dinner to celebrate. When the call finally drops, Bex exhales, a long whoosh of defeat. I know I shouldn't enable you with all the talking, but it's not like I can call anyone on your behalf. They both look down at the image on the home screen of Destiny's laptop. It's a photo that was taken 13 years ago, when Destiny was 8. In it, her mother's arm is flung across Annie's shoulders, happiness radiating from the two best friends in waves. Destiny's eyes fill with tears as she studies her mother's straight black hair and pale skin, and those enormous glasses obscuring most of her face. Jutting her chin at Liz, Bex murmurs, "I wish I'd known her." Destiny nods before turning her attention to Annie, with her striking afro and beaded shoulder duster earrings, and her smile as bright as the sun. The image was captured 2 weeks before Liz died, and a year before the paperwork would go through to officially make Annie Destiny's second adoptive mother. Their deaths were wrenching losses, tearings in the fabric of Destiny's being that she never quite stitched back together. There were times in the before when Destiny experienced the sting of loneliness, that awful yearning of the one forever stuck outside, nose and palms pressed against the cold glass, gazing in at what belonging looked like. Foreheads bent together, raucous laughter elicited by inside jokes, sentences finished by those who knew you best. But this is not loneliness, in the same way that a drop of water is not a deluge, the way a sigh is not a hurricane. "I'm so sorry that you're having such a rough time of it," Beck says, reaching out to tuck a flaming red curl behind Destiny's ear. She freezes upon seeing Destiny's expression, her hand hovering like a ghost between them. "A year is a long time, though. And Dr. Shepherd is right, despite the fact that she clearly has it in for me. You need to move on." God, that Bex is apologizing to her, of all people, when everything that happened was Destiny's fault. "No, I'm sorry," Destiny says, her voice pulled so taut that it snaps. Seeing the pills all standing to attention, no longer a cemetery full of headstones, but rather an army, ready to fight the last battle. Destiny reaches for the urn again, stroking it like a security blanket. If you stop talking to me, Bex, I don't know what I'll do.
Not gonna happen, Bex replies breezily. And then, more firmly, she says, okay, it's tough love time. You seriously need to shower because you're stinking up the place. Plus, the kitchen needs cleaning. Those takeout containers have grown thumbs. I swear I caught them trying to hitch a ride to the nearest primordial swamp. Destiny laughs at how incredibly bossy Bex is. Especially for a dead person. Still, it's reassuring that no matter how much has changed, some things stay exactly the same. Chapter 2. Destiny. Sunday, 10:15 a.m. Destiny flinches at the unmistakable sound of the mail slot creaking open and a letter fluttering through. If she was waiting for a sign, then the arrival of a letter from the council would surely be it. Ignore it, Bex pleads as Destiny pushes her laptop aside to get out of bed. Who needs those losers anyway? Bex has never understood Destiny's affinity for the council. But then why would she? Even before she died, Bex always managed to fit in. Near the end, when her eating disorder began devouring her whole, most people didn't even notice because she constantly surrounded herself with similarly emaciated women in an industry that normalized her illness. But until the council, Destiny never knew what it was like to have peers. When other children her age were being invited to birthday parties or endlessly obsessing over their first crushes, Destiny was attending lectures at Yale, not only thoroughly annoying her professors, who felt they were above babysitting duties, but also the other students, who saw her as a precocious pain in the ass whose presence made them all look bad. Nerd, geek, dork, dweeb, freak, brown nose, boffin, propeller head, prodigy, wonk. They called her everything but her name, making Destiny feel like a lone pelican in a flamboyance of flamingos, so bumbling and awkward that she'd never fit in even if she doused herself with pink paint and walked on stilts. But the day she got the council's invitation, those hallowed hallways opening for her, Destiny found a squadron of other pelicans, with their shoulders hunched and giant beaks agape, devouring knowledge as hungrily and indiscriminately as she did. They welcomed her as a contemporary, someone to be consulted rather than avoided, allowing Destiny, for the very first time in her life, to embrace her very pelicanness. And now, here she is, about to be booted out of the only club she's ever cared about. Shuffling to the front door, she spots a dove gray envelope that's landed face up on the bamboo flooring. Her name, written across it in antiquated script, Destiny Whip. There's no address or stamp, which Destiny thinks is strange until she remembers that it's a Sunday and that no postal workers will be delivering mail today. She peers out through the peephole, spotting a cloak so black that it's almost blue. It disappears into the elevator with a swoosh, a matador challenging a bull, before the doors ding closed. A heaviness gathers and settles in Destiny's stomach. Apparently, the council is so desperate to take her name off their letterheads that they've sent an emissary on the weekend. She wonders which one drew the short stick. Her money's on poor Dodkins, a delightfully eccentric little man whose area of specialty is 19th century puzzle boxes from the Hakone region of Japan. Sighing, Destiny trudges back to bed. Her laptop rings again. Dr. Shepherd calling once more. But Destiny slams it closed, not wanting any witnesses to this humiliation. Beck sits next to Destiny, ineffectually trying to fluff the pillows. The envelope doesn't have the pretentious wax seal, so it can't be from the council. Maybe you've been nominated for another award, she exclaims, ever the optimist. But no, that can't be it. All of Destiny's work correspondence occurs over email. Her inbox, full of hundreds of unread emails, can attest to that. After slicing the envelope open with the lone jagged fingernail she hasn't gnawed off yet, Destiny withdraws the page. Dearest Miss Whip, I hereby acknowledge receipt of your application to replace Miss LaRue as the Scruffmore family historian. I'm sure you know how coveted the position is. It's no secret that ours is a most illustrious and mysterious lineage. And so I congratulate you on your compelling application and for making the shortlist of two approved applicants. Our family history has been a rather fascinating one, with most of the information required to unlocking it hidden within the Scruffmore vault, safe from prying eyes. Were you to be successful, you would be one of the rare outsiders granted access to those thousands of records that have come from all over the world, wherever a Scruffmore has lived in the past 2,000 years. Come via the last ferry on the 27th of February, and then make your way to the Grimshaw Inn and Tavern for the night. Tell them arrangements have been made, and all expenses will be taken care of. Be at the castle on the morning of the 28th, ahead of your interview at 12 p.m. Should you be awarded the position, the secrets of the vault will be yours to be revealed. Until then, Mordecai Scruffmore, Scruffmore Castle, Erie Island. P.S. Your ferry tickets have been purchased. The ticket number for the 27th is L2-3-3-4-5-7-7-8-8-9-12-12-14-14-16-13-4-7. And that of the return is W1-7-10-2-4-2-4-5-11-2-1-11-2-4-5-9-8-1-9. The original read-through is confusing. Told you it would be something interesting, Bex crows. But I'm not a historian, Destiny replies, brow furrowed. And I never applied for this position. Weird, Bex says, tapping her French manicure against her chin. Have you ever heard of the Scruffmore family? Destiny mulls it over. No. The name is unusual enough that she'd remember it. Google them, Bex instructs, her answer to everything. Destiny opens her laptop again with a pang of guilt over Dr. Shepherd's two missed calls. She makes a mental note to pay for the consultation and email an apology. Googling the Scruffmore family gets zero hits. Same goes for Mordecai Scruffmore. Nor is there mention anywhere of the job listing. Erie Island comes up as a vague blip on the map about 30 miles offshore from the town of Gwillimbury. While the ferry terminal is listed as being a 3-hour train trip away, there isn't any mention of the island's castle or the Grimshaw Inn and Tavern. There are no pictures of the island at all, not even satellite images on Google Earth. What the hell? Destiny mutters. Her mind begins to fizz like it's being carbonated. She welcomes the old familiar sensation. How alive it makes her feel. Doing a deeper dive, Destiny scrolls through dozens of search engine result pages before finally being rewarded with one grainy photograph of Mordecai Scruffmore. It's listed with no explanation beyond being captioned with his name on a defunct website that was designed before Destiny was even born. Well, isn't he delightful? Bex murmurs, studying all the star tattoos inked across Mordecai Scruffmore's forehead. While Destiny can believe some kind of administrative error resulted in the letter being sent to her, she can't understand why there's barely any mention of the Scruffmores or their island anywhere on the internet, especially not if the family is as prestigious as they claim. Picking up the page, she reads it again, noting that today is the 27th of February, the day on which she's meant to arrive. She wonders if this is some kind of prank, but something about the letter niggles. As she studies it more closely, Destiny's jaw drops when she spots the key to unlocking the hidden message. You now have all the information you require to figure out the key to unlocking the hidden message. Note, you can find the letter in the accompanying booklet. Pause your audio to solve the puzzle now. Or if you're unable to do so at this time, but would still like the opportunity to do so later, continue listening. If you aren't interested in solving this puzzle, go to Answers, Puzzle 1, The Hidden Message. Chapter 2, Destiny, Continued. Once the secret has revealed itself, Destiny's hands begin to shake so violently that she puts the page down so she won't rip it. This is the letter she's been waiting her entire life for, the one she never dared believe would actually arrive. She feels lightheaded, sick with expectation. The last time she felt this way was when she found the other letter, the one that arrived mere days before her mother's death. That one was signed, Yours, Kai. Mordecai and Kai, two mysterious letters arriving 13 years apart, signed with similar names. That can't be a coincidence, surely. Destiny's heartbeat stomps out a rapturous percussion of something she hasn't felt in a long time. It takes her a moment to identify it as hope.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Litera Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Litera Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Beta reader matchup time is happening again. It's been so gratifying over the summer to be tagged in so many posts about beta readers who've become writing besties and who are still going strong many years after they were first matched. Some even travel to meet up and do writing weekends together, which sounds incredible.
I can't guarantee any of that. That's entirely up to you. But what I can guarantee is that you'll be matched with a group of people working in your genre and or time zone who will critique 3,000 words of your work as you critique theirs in return. You can sign up from now until the 31st of August with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of September. Head to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.